Okay, we're beginning here at the Gemara on the top of Ayin Bet Amud Aleph. Tanyo, Rabbi Yossi Aglili Omer, V'chib bnei she'achal zeh tartimar basar v'shata chatzilog yayin ha'italki amra Torah yetze de beitin lisakel. So Rabbi Yossi Aglili, interestingly enough, begins his statement the same way that Rabbi Shimon did yesterday. They both begin with the fact that it would be impossible to fathom that because this guy eats some meat and drinks some wine, he ends up with a death penalty or being stoned. So Rabbi Shimon leaves it there and says, that just can't be. It just can't be that there is a ben sorer morer, that this is a reality. Yossi Aglili takes the more traditional approach that we're used to seeing here, Ele Igia Torah, the sof dato shel ben sorer morer. The Torah reaches to the depth of understanding of what's going to happen to this child if he continues down this path. So sof megamer nechse aviv. Then he's going to finish off the possessions of his father. He's going to waste away the estate. Umevakesh limudo. And he is addicted. He wants to continue this type of lifestyle. Beinu motzei. And he doesn't have the ability to attain it. He doesn't have the resources to do it. Yotzei the parshat ha-drachim. Goes out to the forks in the road. It really means out on the roads or the places. Umelastem et abriot. Then he starts to rob, be a marauder, kill, whatever he needs to do to acquire the assets that allow him to continue the lifestyle that he's become accustomed to. Amra Torah, Yamut Zakai, Vayamut Chayav. Better off that he dies now, while he's still innocent, rather than allowing him to go through the process that's going to make him culpable. And then the Gemara continues here with what was found in the Mishnah as well. Shemitatan Shel Rishaim, Hanalahem, Vanali Olam. Because when Rishaim die, it's beneficial to them, beneficial to the world, beneficial to them because then they stop sinning, beneficial to the world because they're not subject to the difficulties caused by these rishaim or the evil plots that they have. Well, the tzaddikim, when the tzaddikim pass away, ralahem, it's bad for them because they can no longer perform mitzvot. Rali olam, because the olam is no longer the beneficiary of their protection of the mitzvot that they do. Shina v'yayin the rishaim, sleep and wine for the rishaim. Hanalahem, it's good for them. Vana the olam, it's good for the world. It's good for them because it keeps them preoccupied while they're drinking, while they're sleeping. They're not doing evil things. They're not engaged in untoward behavior. So therefore, for them, it's good. It's also good for the world because they're spared having the Rishaim out there doing whatever it is that they are doing. The Tzaddikim, for the Tzaddikim, Ralahem, it's bad for them because then they are not engaged in learning of Torah. They're not engaged in doing mitzvot. For Adi Olam, and it's bad for the world because they provide the protection to the world through their doing a mitzvot and their learning of Torah, and that's lost when they are sleeping and when they are drinking, when they are not engaged in those activities. Sheket l'rishayim, when things are tranquil, peaceful, that thing is going on, meaning that people are free to do what they want. Ralahem v'ralah olam, that's bad for the rishayim and bad for the world. Bad for the rishayim because now they're going to engage in other activities. They're not preoccupied with anything else. They don't have to take care of other matters. And so that tranquility allows them the opportunity to do bad things. So it's bad for them because they are bored and they are stacking up more sins. And it's bad for the world because that free reign allows them to do bad things, which is bad for the world. The tzaddikim, on the other hand, the peace and tranquility, that freedom for the tzaddikim, on the other hand, is positive for them because then they can engage in Torah and mitzvot. But now the olam, for that same reason, that they are the beneficiaries of the tzaddikim being engaged in Torah and mitzvot. Pizur, disbursement, meaning that they are chased away, split up, not able to live together. The Rishaim, when it comes to Rishaim, Analahem v'Nadolam, it's beneficial to the Rishaim and to the world. Rishaim, because then they can't plot together, they can't take advice from one another, they can't learn from each other's ways. That distribution of them into far-flung places makes it better for them, because then they sin less, and better for the world for that same reason. Tzadikim, it's the opposite, because the Chabur of Tzadikim help each other to learn, help each other to do good things, and therefore, Ralahem v'Nadolam. Obviously, that's the concept behind the ben sorer umore, which is his nidon l'shem sofo, that we're better off in certain circumstances when a person's not here than when he is here. If he is here, he's going to continue to do terrible things. He's going to engage in behavior which is negative and only add up to more negative points, negative action by him, and that will lead him down the path of being a rasha and much worse. But it also is to the detriment of the world to have him around, because if he acts like that, going to affect the victims of his behavior, of his reshut. So therefore, his elimination is beneficial to the world. Now again, here, we're not talking about someone who is innocent. This isn't an individual who's done nothing wrong. We already saw yesterday, there's a certain protocol, certain type of behavior. Person's been warned. He's been given malkot. He's been warned again. It's not somebody who's coming here where there's no background and there's no evidence of the fact that they're leading a lifestyle that is going to lead to something terrible, because they've demonstrated already a disregard for authority, disregard for Beit Din, for enforcement. They know that there's something wrong here and they continue to do this. They continue to steal, continue to eat the Masar and Yayin. Again, I mentioned yesterday, it's similar to the Sota. The woman who is a Sota comes up and has to drink the Mei Sota. Even if she's found innocent, this woman is not innocent to start with. She was warned not to seclude with a man, and she secluded with the man. Now we're dealing with whether there was something that happened in that seclusion or not. But the mere fact that she did seclude with this individual and had yichud with this individual is already problematic from the start. So we're not dealing with someone who's innocent when you start out here, and therefore all the procedures and protocols that surround the sota are not a woman who maybe is innocent, maybe is guilty. That's true in the final act of whether she had an extramarital affair. But until that point of what brought her there were decisions that were difficult and negative in nature. And the same thing with the Ben Soreru Moreh. The only other thing to address, which is somewhat difficult, is the punishment of the Ben Soreru Moreh. The punishment is skila. On the other hand, the fear that we have here is that he's going to sit at the forks in the roads, at the junctions, and then he's going to be molested to briot, steal, and kill. Even if he was found to be a murderer, the punishment for a murderer is saif, not skila. So why is he deserving of skila and not saif, which is the ultimate thing that we're worried about, is that he's going to kill in order to maintain his lifestyle. So that Rishonim tried to deal with. Either this is a deterrent, it's a way to stop the individual from engaging this behavior because of the severity of the punishment, or, like yesterday we discussed with Droshu Kabel Skar, this is an indication by the Torah about the priority and paramounts that the Torah places on this issue of chinuch, of children, their behavior, how they act, the interaction with society, interaction with the parents, that this is something that the Torah takes very seriously. And we know that from other places where we say that the kavod of parents is dome the kavod of makom, or fear of parents is dome the fear of the makom, and that parents are held in a certain level and esteem, and this individual who disregards his parents and doesn't listen to their instruction, that is a significant breach of what the Torah views as being important or a priority. In addition, we know that Mikalela Vivi Mo, someone who curses a parent, is also subject to skila. And so maybe subsumed in this is someone who is Mikalela Vivi Mo, whether that's explicit or whether it's implicit in his behavior and the way that he acts, that he's causing that as if he's cursing his parents or as if he's causing others to curse his parents. And that there are reasons to suggest that maybe the punishment should be this severe or should be skila because of the interaction between the child and the parents. Although again, just from a generic standpoint, does present an issue that if he's going to kill, then why not give him the punishment of saif rather than skila? And that's why we just gave all those alternate reasons or options as to why maybe the Torah focuses in that way. So the next Mishnah leads us into the world of machteret, based on these two psukim in Parshat Mishpatim. Im b'machteret imatzei ganav. If a ganav is coming in through tunneling, vehuka v'meit, and then he is killed because he's entering that way, ein lo damim. The balabait is not responsible for that. He is permitted to defend himself and not allow this individual to enter his house. Im zarcha hashemesh alav, if the sun has risen on him, damim lo, then the balabait will be held accountable for killing him. Shalem yishalem, im ein lo v'nim kar b'gnevato. And he has to pay back that which he is stealing. And if he doesn't have what to pay, then he will be sold in his gneva or because of his gneva. So Bama Machteret is a type of theft that involves tunneling under, coming into the house in a manner that is secretive in nature. Part of the issue is that when you tunnel in, you really only have one option in terms of getting out, and that is confront the balabait. If you are successful at stealing and going back out, then obviously there's no problem here of confronting the balabait. That would be your best scenario if you're the ganav. On the other hand, you know that there's a risk or even possible likelihood that you will bump into the owner of the house. You have to make a decision at that point. If you're making this effort to dig under the house and come in that way and are confronted by the Baal HaBayit, what's going to happen? The Gemara assumes, we're going to see this all in the Gemara, I'm just laying it out for you, that a person who is being robbed by someone who's coming underground into their house is not going to stand by and watch the individual take his possessions, but he's rather going to take action. The action he's going to take is to defend himself and to defend his property, and that means to take the life of the ganav. He will kill the ganav in order to protect himself and his possession. That means that when the ganav enters, he is fully cognizant of the fact that if he bumps into the Baal HaBayit, the Baal HaBayit is going to take severe action against him. That means that he also knows when he enters that if the Baal HaBayit is going to take action against him, he's going to want to defend himself or make sure that he gets out of there without being caught. How does he do that? He kills the Baal HaBayit. So now we've painted a scenario which leads us down the path of why the Baal Machteret is subject to a death penalty or be allowed to be killed by the Baal HaBayit. Because of his entry and his assumption that he will have to kill, there is someone attempting to stop him if the owner tries to stop him, that means that he's coming to murder, if necessary. Once he does that, he opens up the possibility of being considered a rodef, and if he's coming to kill someone else, then they have the right to defend themselves by killing him. And so that's the concept behind a Baal Machteret. Gemara is going to give more detail about it, I'm just giving you the big picture. Abav Machteret Nidono Shem Sofo. So obviously that's why it's found here with Ben Sorer Umoreh. Nidono Shem Sofo, which is we look at the ultimate outcome of what's going to happen when someone tunnels into a house. Just like the Ben Sorer Umoreh, we look at what's the outcome going to be on the long run. So too over here, we look at this individual. Ayabav Machteret Vishiber Techavit. If he comes through the Machteret and smashes something on his way in, Im Yeshlo Damim Chayav. If the Baal HaBayit is restricted from killing him, that he'll be held responsible if he kills him, then chayav, then he's responsible to pay for that which he damaged. Im ein lo damim, if the Baal HaBayit has permission to kill the ganav, then the ganav is patur because we have kimlei b'derabe mine. If he's subject to a death penalty, then you can't force him to pay at the same time because you have two punishments, the punishment of his death and the punishment of the monetary claim that you have against him. The death penalty will override the monetary claim, even though over here, he's not necessarily going to be killed, and he doesn't know that he's going to be killed. But we have a principle with Kimlei Deraba Minei, that it has application even be'chayim ve'mito chogegim. Even if somebody unintentionally kills and subject to galut, that individual is also patur, we still say Kimlei Deraba Minei. It is the act of killing or the possibility that you could be killed that free you of the obligation to make monetary compensation. Samarova, my time of the machteret. What's the reason behind the machteret? Chazaka, ein adam amid atzmo al mimono. There is a chazaka that people will not stand idly by while someone else walks off with their property or takes their property. They will defend themselves. They will try to protect themselves and their property in many states. In the United States and other countries as well, there are laws in terms of the owners defending themselves. If you break or enter into their property, you trespass, the owners are given free rein to protect their property. That means even at the expense of the life of the person who trespassed, once you enter into the property, you subject yourself to the defense of the Baal HaBayit, and he's given free rein to defend his property, to defend his family, and to kill him. There are places where if you could use less than fatal force, then you will be held accountable if you use fatal force because stop them with less. In other cases, the states do not have that restriction. If you enter the property, once you enter the property, you know you are subject to the retaliation of the Baal HaBayit, and it doesn't matter how fatal force he uses, even if he could have used less than fatal force. Vai me ma'amar. So then the Ganav says, Ia zilna kai lapai, velo shavikli. If the Baal HaBayit comes to stop me and block my exit or stop me from stealing, then if he comes to stop me or tries to kill me, I'm going to kill him. And therefore the Torah says, "In someone comes to kill you, then you have the right to go forward and kill him preemptively in order to protect yourself. So defensively, you're allowed to protect yourself because the underlying assumption here is the ganav will kill in order to execute on what he's trying to do. That's because he knows that the Baal HaBayit will stand up for his property and for his life. And so he knows that there's a chance that there will be an altercation with the Baal HaBayit, which will lead to his possibly being killed. That means the Ganav comes armed or with the assumption that he will kill in order to do whatever he wants to do. That means now he is attempting to murder. You can protect yourself by preemptively or defensively killing him. There is a question of basic hakira here in the Bama Machteret, which is, why are you allowed to kill here? Are you allowed to kill here because the Torah justifies or allows vigilantism in these cases? Since your life is in danger, the only way for you to get out of this is to protect yourself and take the law into your own hands? Or do we see you as a proxy for Beit Din? Beit Din in this case says we have someone who's coming in to kill, and Beit Din would then be instructed to stop that individual, to kill that individual, to protect society or to protect the other individuals. So then are you acting as a proxy of Beit Din? Are you simply a extension of the arm of the law, which is sometimes the law can't reach these situations? So they, in essence, deputize you to act on their behalf to kill this individual or to stop them. There will be nafka minot as to whether you are a proxy of Beit Din or whether you're acting on your own, as to whether you need certain protocols that are normally needed by Beit Din, or whether you're freed of those protocols in these situations. All right, so now, if this halacha is the basic halacha of in Baruch Horchecha Hashkem Lahor Go, then what is the difference necessarily between a machteret and any other case where someone is chasing down an individual trying to kill them, and you have a right to defend yourself, or other people have the right to intercede to protect the individual who will be the victim? So how is this different? So first of all, it says in the Torah Amra, the Torah says, where does the Torah say this? We don't have the quote here from the Gemara where the Torah says this, that you're allowed to defend yourself. Gemara later on will bring the Hatra'ah, the warning given to Rodef, as being the Pasuk that's found by Bnei Noach, with Shofech, Dam Adam Adam, Damo Yishofech. And that might be what the Gemara is referencing to over here, Amra Torah, which is that is the most explicit Pasuk that seems to indicate that you have a right, Rashi will say it over there, that everybody has the right to take the life of the individual who is causing other blood to be spilled or attempting to spill the blood of others. And so, even though it seems the wrong pasuk to bring as the Hatra'ah, but the fact that the Gemara does bring it as the Hatra'ah tells you that the Gemara thinks that that is what the pasuk is speaking about, and that might be the source of what we're saying over here, Amra Torah. Or we do have a pasuk which we're going to use in the cases of Yehareg Val Yavor by the Nara Murasa. It says over there, just like someone gets up to kill another, so too is the case of the rape of a Nara Maruasa, which means that the person is a victim of circumstances, and therefore, from there we learn the ability to defend oneself. Or the other possibility is, the Tanchuma brings it from the pasuk, Tsororet Tamid Yonim V'Kitem Otam, Ki Tsororim Heim Lachem, B'Nich Lechem Asher Niklu Lachem Al Devar Peor. So the Torah instructs you to go preemptively and take out the Midyanim because they're causing difficulty and problems for you. So that's another possibility of this din. Or, Bama Machteret itself seems to indicate such because it says, Ein lo damim, that the person who kills to protect himself, protect his property, is not held accountable. And that seems also to be possibly the source for the fact that one is allowed to defend themselves in these situations. So now, once you say that it's similar to that din, then how is Bava Machteret different? The Rabbeinu Yehonatan suggests that in the case of Machteret, you do not have to take the precaution of doing the least amount to protect yourself. Normally we would ask you, do the least amount to protect yourself. That means that you're not allowed to use fatal force when you could have used something less, and you'll actually be considered a murderer if you use fatal force in those situations. In this situation, Bava Machteret, you have free rein. Because of the situation, the circumstance, the difficulty, especially since it's at night, we're going to see that in a second. If you look at the Pashtut HaPasuk, it's because he's digging under, tunneling under at night. If the sun rises on him when it's daytime already, and then you can make discernment about the situation, there you might be required to not use fatal force when you don't have to. At night, where there's a lot of uncertainty, there is problems, especially in their day, where there is no lighting, there's no ability to see at night, so then there is no ability to be discerning in how you protect yourself. And therefore you're given free rein to use fatal force, even though less than fatal force could have been used to stop the situation. And that might be the chiddush of Abba Machteret that is not applicable in the other circumstances of Embalo Korcha, Hashkeim Lehorgo. And that's what would make this case unique. The Rabbeinu Yehonatan says that's actually what is the meaning of Nidono Shem Sofo, that we are not guided by the full principles of Rodeif, rather under the assumption he's coming to kill. And since that's the case, we do whatever it takes in order to eliminate this individual, especially given the circumstances that are involved. Amarav, Abba Machteret, V'naktal Kelim, V'yatza Patur. Person who comes in V'machteret, steals, takes items with him, and then leaves, he is Patur. My Taima, what's the reason? Bidamim Kananu, he acquired them with his blood. I mean, since his life was at risk, and he was subject to the death penalty while he was in the house, that means that he is now facing a possibility of death, as well as the requirement to repay for the theft that he's engaged in. Since the death warrant on him at the time that he's stealing, he was subject to being killed. That frees him of the responsibility to having to pay, at least bidei adam. Let's say bidei shamayim, he still might have to. That goes to the question by Kimle Derabimine, whether we view the compensation as being totally wiped out, or it's just suspended because of the death punishment or death penalty that he would receive. Amarova, Mistavra Milde de Rav, Rav's statement makes sense, Bishishiber, when he breaks the keli, Delaytnehu, because it's no longer extant, and his obligation is then a monetary obligation. If he breaks the kli, now he has to repay it, so now he has a monetary obligation. A monetary obligation cannot come into force at the same time he's subject to a death penalty. Aval Natal, lo. He walks out with the kli, and he still has the kli, then he should be obligated to return the kli. The basic assumption is that it's still owned by the owner. When he steals the kli and the kli is intact, you have a requirement in the Torah, v'shivat gzela asher gazal. You have to return the object that you stole. If the object is extant, you actually have to return that physical object. That object then seemingly remains in possession of the owner, and that's why you have to return it. If the object is broken, lost, something happens to the object, then he only has a monetary obligation. In that case, you can argue that the monetary obligation can't come into effect when he has a death penalty associated with him. But the object of the balabait, which he's holding, it's as if it's a pikadon by him. It's as if it's a deposit with him because it still belongs to the original owner. He's just responsible for it. So Rava says, if he breaks in and becomes into a monetary obligation, you're right. But if he actually takes the object and walks out with it, he should have to return the object because it's independent of whether he has a death penalty or not. It belongs to the owner. It remains in the possession of the owner. And so therefore, he should have to return it. Elokim, Amar Rava, feeling that down. What are you talking about? In God's name, Rav said it, even if you walk out with it. Daha, because we have this situation. Yeshlo damim, if the balabait would have been held accountable for killing this individual, v'nansu, and then the kelim were broken by an onus, chayav, the ganav is chayav in that case. Alma, birshutei kaime. You see that it is in his possession. Hachanami birshutei kaime. So to over here, it's in the ganav's possession. What you see here is that in a situation or a case where the balabait is not permitted to kill the ganav, so we lose this kimle derabamine, the ganav in that case is responsible for the kelim. That means that if something happens to them, even accidentally, he is responsible. That shows you that the ganav is in possession of these items and responsible for the items. They're in his possession. They're not in the owner's possession. They were in the owner's possession and some onus happens, then the ganav should not be responsible for that because he's not the owner, and something accidental happened to the objects, then it shouldn't be his responsibility. On the other hand, if you see it in the possession of the ganav, that means now that he has a monetary obligation here because he took something that didn't belong to him, and then the onus happens, it doesn't really matter. The fact that he can't return the item makes him obligated to pay because he has an obligation to return the item that it came into his possession. If you believe, like Rava, that it stayed in the possession of the owner all the way along, if something accidental happens, that means it happened to the owner's property. The ganav should not be responsible for that. It was an ones. And for that, you see that it's in the reshut of the ganav and not the reshut of the balabait. Elohi. Rava says it's not true. The proof that you're bringing, that Rav would say it in that instance, and the proof you're bringing against me is incorrect. Ki ukimna rachmana bishutei le'inyan unsin. That is because the Torah places it into the possession of the ganav to be responsible for onis. Aval inyan makne birshutei the marayu kaime. But the inyan of kinyan, it remains in the possession of the original owner, midid havei ha-shoel. This is no different than a borrower. A borrower is responsible for anything that happens to the object. That is because of the fact that kol anas shelo, all the benefit accrues to him, and the Baal HaBayit gets nothing from this. So since all anas goes to the shoel, we obligate him in all problems that arise with this object. So if he borrows the item and something goes wrong, even though it wasn't his fault, he still will be responsible for it because the shoel is chayav for everything. So does that mean the shoel owns it? It's in the possession of the shoel? By definition, if he's a borrower, it's not his property. It belongs to the Baal HaBayit. Despite it belonging to the Baal HaBayit, we obligate the shoel to pay for onsin. So too over here. The ganav is treated like a shoel. It is in the possession of the original owner, but he's held culpable for anything that happens to it. We assign responsibility to him, even though he doesn't have ownership over the object, or the object's not in his possession. So even though it's in the Baal HaBayit's possession, we still assign responsibility for the onus that's over here. And that way Rava says, my position is correct, which is that when he breaks it, he won't have to pay. But if he walks out with the object that remains in the possession of the original owner, and you have to return that object, even if you were subject to a death penalty while you were stealing. Tanan, our Mishnah, ba memachteret v'shiber techavit, comes into the machteret and he breaks something on the way in, yesh lo damim, if the Baal HaBayit would not be allowed to kill him, that he would be held responsible for killing him, chayav, ein lo damim, if the Baal HaBayit would not be responsible for killing him, meaning that he had the right to kill him, patur, taima d'shiber, it's only because it was broken, d'chi ein lo damim, patur, in that instance when the Baal HaBayit has the right to kill him, he is patur. Hanatal, lo, if he just walked out with it, that would not be the case. So this would be a proof to Rava. The diogat of our Mishnah is the fact that it says shiber. He broke it. It doesn't say he walked out with something. It says he broke something while he was stealing. That breaking, he is patur from because his life was in danger because the Baal HaBayit could have killed him. On the other hand, you would be medayek from the Mishnah if the guy just walked out with something. He would not be patur. He'd have to return it to the Baal HaBayit. So that diuk favors Rava heavily. Gemara says, Huadin, dafilu natal nami. Gemara comes to the defense of Rav and says that even if you walked out with it, you'd also be patur. Badu katani shiber techavit. So then why does it write it broke it? It would be a bigger chedesh to tell me if he walked out with it that he's patur. Kamash malan, dechi yesh lo damim, that when the Baal HaBayit is held accountable for the death of the ganav, Avagav de Shiber Nami Chayav. So even though he broke it accidentally, he still is considered to be Chayav. The Ganav broke it, not intentionally, it just happened to be that he broke it by accident. Pshita, the Gemara says, why would you think otherwise? Maziku, he is a person who is damaging someone else's property. He should be responsible for that. Hakamash Malan comes to teach us, Dafilu Shalobi Kavana. Even unintentional damage to your fellow Jew's property, you are responsible to compensate for. You're responsible to repay them for those types of accidents. So to over here, the ganav, who's going to be held accountable because the Baal HaBayit's not allowed to kill him, he's held accountable even if by accident he breaks something, even though he does something that's not intentional. My kamash malan, what does that teach you? Adam mu'ad li'olam. Unlike other situations where ones rachmana patre, the Torah says, by ones you are patur, by Adam you are a mu'ad li'olam. You're considered to be problematic from start to finish. A person who injures, a person who damages, doesn't matter whether they are intentionally, unintentionally, by accident, not by accident, they're held accountable for all of their actions. And so therefore, over here, that's what we're teaching you, that the person, even though he broke it unintentionally, he's still responsible. Gemara says, Tanina, I don't need you to tell me out of our Mishnah that. We have an explicit Mishnah that tells us. Adam mu'ad olam, ben shogeg, ben mezi, ben onis, ben aratzon. This we know explicitly from the Mishnah that says a person is always accountable for his behavior. Whether unintentional, intentional, whether it was accidental, or it was willing. Doesn't matter, you are responsible. Kasha. That is a problem for Rav's explanation of our Mishnah. Rashi notes over here, we've noted this before, that the Mesorah from the Gonim is, that if the Gemara ends with the Tiyufta, That's an unresolvable question, and therefore it upends that position. Well, then if you have a kasha in the Gemara, it means it's a strong question, but not an absolute refutation of that position. You have a strong question on Rav, you don't have an absolute refutation of Rav's position. The problem for Rav is our Mishnah. The Diach of our Mishnah supports Rav's position and not Rav's position. Nevertheless, the Gemara came up with an explanation, a way to explain the Mishnah according to Rav. The Gemara says that explanation, the way Rav explains the Mishnah, is really unnecessary because we have an explicit Mishnah that tells you that information. So why would the Mishnah go out of its way to teach you this din when it explicitly states it in other places? So therefore, it seems to favor Rav's explanation, not Rav's explanation. In the end, the Gemara says, okay, maybe it does favor Rav's explanation, but you're not learning it from the explicit Mishnah, you're learning it out of a diuk from the Mishnah. That diuk from the Mishnah is what is upending Rav, and you can say, it's a diuk, it's not explicit in the Mishnah, therefore it's not an absolute refutation of Rav, and Rav's position could still be true. Or if you follow the way that Rav learns the Mishnah now, and changes it to give you new information, then the chiddush that he's giving, yes, it's said somewhere else, but still, the Mishnah wanted to teach you that additional piece of your information. Both of those are difficult, not easy answers, but they are plausible answers. And since there is that opportunity to defend Rav's position, it's called a kasha, which is a very strong question, but not an absolute refutation of Rav's position. Meitiv Rabibi Barabai. This is a challenge to Rava's position from the Mishnah in Baba Kama. Hagonev Kis B'Shabbat. Mishnah in Baba Kama says, if you steal a wallet or a money pouch on Shabbat, Chayav. You are responsible to repay that which you stole. Because the death penalty that he will be subject to for violating the Shabbat happens later or after he's already stolen the object. When he comes into the house and he lifts up the object to steal it, that's called a kinyan hagba. That kinyan hagba makes him a ganav on the spot. He's not chayav for violating Shabbat until he walks out of the house, going from the reshuta yachid into the reshuta rabim. So his Isur Shabbat that he violates is later or after he already stole. So they're not simultaneous. Because of that, he is now responsible to pay the person back because that obligation preceded his being subject to a death penalty for violating this Shabbat. On the other hand, Hayam Migarer Biyotze, if he was dragging the object along and then leaving by dragging it out, that means that the Chilul Shabbat and the Gneva take place simultaneously. Because once he crosses over the line from Reshuta Yechid to Reshuta Rabim, that's when the object goes into his possession. While it's in the owner's property, he's dragging around the owner's property, he hasn't stolen it yet. It's still in the owner's property. So as he pulls it from Reshuta Yechid into Reshuta Rabim, that Mishicha, that pulling of the object, gives him ownership of the object. That's also the moment when he becomes chayav for violating the Shabbat, when it goes from Mishuta Yachid to Mishuta Rabim. In that case, they are simultaneous. The violation of the Gneva and the violation of Shabbat happen at the same moment, crossing over from Mishuta Yachid to Mishuta Rabim. Therefore, it's Kimlei Deraba Minei, and he would be Patur. Shrei Isur Gneva, Isur Skila, Baim Kechad. Because in that case, they both come simultaneously. Now, there are a couple of qualifications over here, and about Tosafot of Baba Kama, note this, which is, first of all, the object has to be so heavy that you couldn't pick it up by a kinyan agba. As we saw in the Gemara in Baba Batra, if you have an option to do a kinyan agba, then you don't have a right to use lesser kinyanim like a kinyan mishicha. So it has to be that this sack is big enough that you would drag it across the ground, and that'd be a normal way to move it, so that kinyan agba is not necessarily a realistic kinyan in this case. That's number one. Number two is, in order to be chayav, you have to go from a discrete location to a discrete location. So over here, you're going from a reshuta yachid into a reshuta rabim. So over there, the Gemara tells us that he actually passes it from reshuta yachid into reshuta rabim with his hand below three tefachim. Since his hand is below three tefachim, his hand is classified as a place that is considered of significance. And since his hand is of significance for dinei Shabbat, that you're placing it down on your hand in Reshuta Rabim. Your hand is deemed to be a location that is significant for Shabbat, as if you're placing it down in a particular location. So that's another qualification. Rashi notes that over here. Your hand is considered like a place of 4x4, and it's as if it's his chatzer. And that's the way the Gemara in Ketubot explains this Mishnah. So those two qualifications are the way that it happens, it's dragged out because it's so heavy, and number two is, it's passed into his hand in the Rishut HaRabim, in order that you're chayav for Shabbat and you're chayav for Gneva at the same time. So now, based on that, Rabbi Bar Abaye says to Rava, you see over here that he's stealing, he didn't break it, yet he's still patur. Even though he could have returned the object intact, he's stealing something that is still extant, he didn't break it, he doesn't have to pay it back when there's Kimlei D'Rabbanan, he's patur. In that case, according to you, Rava, if he takes the object's still extant, he has to give it back. Over here, the Mishnah says that you don't have to give it back. Rava answers, V'ilchada d'shanidu b'naro. The loche of that Mishnah, Rava says, only applies when he throws it into the river. He does something to destroy the object, or rid himself of the object. That's what makes him a patur from returning it, because at the moment that he became chayav Shabbat, his gneva resulted in a destruction of that object. And the destruction of that object then is a monetary claim against him, and it's no longer that he's returning the object that he took. Eino chanami, if the object was still extant, he'd have to return it. It's only because he destroyed the object through in his gneva that there he doesn't have to pay back, because it's a monetary obligation. You can't be chayav, a death penalty, and a monetary obligation simultaneously. Ironically, Rava igniv le dichrei b'machtarto. He had these rams or these ayalim stolen to him with people who tunneled in and took these animals. So here he has a case of exactly what Rava is being discussed, and the animals now are intact or extant. So according to Rava, Rava the Shitato should require them to return the object, because they are not patur, according to Rava, because the object is still there. Ahadrinu niale, so sure enough, the Ganavim came and they returned it to him. Velo kablinu, and he refused to accept it. Amar hol v'nofag mi pumei d'Rav. Since Rav said it, I'm choshesh v'shitat Rav. Rav's shita is that the Ganavim are patur in this case, even when the object is still extant. So this is a tremendous Musar Haskel. Rava thought he was right. Rava believed in his position. Despite that when it came to his own possessions and it came to Pesach Halacha, he had tremendous respect for Rav's position. And he was choshesh for Rav's position and didn't accept back the object from the Ganavim, because he thought they might be patur according to Rav. Even though the Shitato, the Ganavim would be chayav. That's number one. Number two is, don't we have a principle in general? And as we said before, that even when you have Kimlei Rabbanan and you're patur, there's still a side of being Yotzei Yidei Shamayim, which is that even though they may be Turim, Bidinei Adam, Bidinei Shamayim, they really do need to pay it back and replace the object. So why over here did Rover refuse to accept it from them? Maybe they were coming to be, let's say, Yidei Shamayim, and they wanted to return the object. So the Bali Tosafot say over there, Tema, I'm a chayav, let's say, Yidei Shamayim. So why did he refuse to take it? V'yesh lamar, tekan lo ayu rotzim lachzir, elim ken yitzchayvu b'dinei adam. They only wanted to return it if they thought the court would enforce it. They weren't going to turn it, even though voluntarily they were returning it, they wouldn't return it unless they felt that the court would come after them and force them to return it. The courts weren't going to force them to return it, then they wouldn't feel compelled to return it, they wouldn't have returned it. So therefore Rava didn't feel comfortable taking the object from them, because he didn't believe that they really intended to give it back to him. And Rav says you're patur, Rava himself says you're chayav, but because of that chashash for Rav's position, which we see in other places in Shas, for instance a case in the Gemara in Megillah, as to whether you need a minyan for a reading of Megillah, Mizmano. And over there, the Gemara brings the similar type of thing, that even though there's a machloket about the davar, that Rav, that choshesh, you do require a minyan, and even though he personally thought you didn't need a minyan, he still read the Megillah with a minyan because of that. So you see this idea that the Chachamim, despite what their position is, they have respect and are choshesh for the shita of the other party. We also see that in the beginning of Yevamot, in the machlokot between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, despite their differences in din, they were respectful of each other's positions, and they used to indicate to each other when something or an issue would be for them, even though it wasn't an issue for the particular person because they had a different shita. So this is a nice idea in terms of kvod chachamim and the camaraderie as well as the respect that's given between the chachamim over here. Tana Banan. The Gemara here is going to parse the pasuk differently. The first pasuk says, Im achter yimatzei aganav ukav amet ein lo damim. The next pasuk begins, Im zarcha shemesh alav damim lo. So the Im Zarcha Shemesh sits between the two statements. The one statement of Ein Lo Damim, which is from the previous Pasuk, and the Pasuk of Damim Lo, which is in that Pasuk. So the question is, which one do you read it with? And the truth is, maybe you read it with both. We're going to see in a second that the bright don't do that. So here, the Gemara in the first case brings Eino Damim, which is the end of the first pasuk, where the balabait is not responsible for killing the ganav. Then it says, Im zarcha shemesh alav. V'chei shemesh alav bilvad zarcha. Did the sun rise only on the ganav, not on the whole world? Elayim barur lacha davar kishemesh. If it is clear to you like the sun, she'ein lo shalom imcha, hargeyu, then you kill him. So it says, when is it ein lo damim? When are you considered to have the right to kill the ganav? Im zarcha alav hashemesh. If you're certain that the person who's coming with machteret is coming to kill. So if you're certain about that, then you have a right to defend yourself and kill him. V'im lav, if not, al targeyu, then you don't have a right to kill him. Which would imply that if you aren't certain as to whether he's coming to kill or not, you may not kill him. Tanya yidach, an opposing braita, im zarcha shemesh alav, damim lo. So here they do it the other way around, which is im zarcha alav shemesh, damim lo. Then the baal bayit is responsible, held accountable for killing the ganav. Once again, that the sun just rise on the ganav, not on everybody else. If it's clear to you that he's coming in a peaceful manner, al deargeyu, do not kill him. That implies, v'imlav, if you are not certain that he's there, even in uncertainty, hargeyu, you have the right to kill him. You have two stam braitot that seem to be arguing on each other as to what the default situation is when a ganav comes in. Meaning that in certain circumstances, we say, you must check first. And if you don't check, you're going to be held accountable for murder. The other case, we say, you don't have to check. You only have to worry if you know for certain that this person is coming peacefully. So the implications from the two braitot are, what's the situation in default? But what is the situation in a safek? The first braitot indicates you're not allowed to kill. The second braitot indicates that you're allowed to kill. Lokash, the Gemara says, it's not a problem. Kan ve'av ala ben, kan be'ben alav. Depends on the circumstance. One case is a father digging in a tunnel to his son's property. The other case is a son digging in to his father's property. The Gemara here has an underlying principle, which is v'adai rachmei av ala ben. That the feeling of a parent towards a child is so strong that a parent would never kill a child. And so therefore, when a father comes in be'machteret, the underlying assumption, the default assumption is he's not there to kill. That means that the son doesn't have a right to defend himself by killing his father who's coming in. Elim Ken, he's certain that his father will kill him. If he's certain that his father will kill him, then he has a right to defense. If it's a safek, we assume that the father is part of the majority, and fathers in general will not kill their children, as opposed to the other way around, where you have a son entering the father's house. The son does not have those strong feelings towards the father, and therefore the assumption is when the son enters, and Rashi says, Kol shekeinin ish da'alma, anybody else who enters the property, you have to assume that they're coming to kill, unless you know for certain that they are coming in peaceful means. That means you have a right to kill, and you don't have to ask questions. No questions asked, you kill, because you assume that they're coming to murder. We actually saw this in the Gemaras previously, where we had three generations where an individual gifted something to his son, and then the son gifted it to his son. And over there, the Gemara says, that shows you the tremendous love a father has for his son versus a son that has for his father. Because over here, the father gifted something to his son that he wanted his son to get benefit for. And so the son, if he really wanted to please his father, he would have utilized it. He would have done things with it. Out of respect for his father, he would have used it. But instead, he gifts it down to his son. That shows you that the father's feeling towards his own son is much stronger than his feeling towards his own father, because he was willing to give it up to his son and not keep it for himself. So he was doing something that benefited his son, even at the expense of offending or affronting his father. So we saw that in the Gemara before, and the Gemara here says something similar, which is the father's feelings towards the child are very strong. So in that way, we answer the two braitot as to what the default position is. The Rishonim, Amifashim ala Torah, explain that the pasuk shouldn't be taken out of context either, which is in Zarcha Lav Shemesh is literally daytime. And then maybe there is no din of machteret during the daytime, because anybody who's digging in during the daytime knows there's a high likelihood that they may be caught, and therefore they're not coming to kill necessarily, because they're understanding or undertaking that type of risk that they're going to be caught. One who's doing it at night is truly trying to hide from the authorities, and he doesn't want to be caught, and he'll do anything to make sure he's not caught. So in that way, maybe it's even a little counterintuitive, which is someone who's more brazen and coming in during the day is also more aware of the fact they're going to be caught and therefore would not kill. You could argue the opposite, which is during the day, if the person is so brazen, then they don't care and they're going to do whatever it takes to get out, then they intend to kill even more so than somebody at night who thinks they're doing it under the cover of dark. So there are Rishonim who take it literally and give the pshat of the pasuk that daytime there is no din of machteret, while others still suggest that it has nothing to do with day or night, but rather our assumption that the individual is coming to kill unless you know otherwise. Amar Rav, kol di'ati ilai b'machtarta katilmone. Rav says, if anybody comes, tunnels into my house, I would kill them. The bar me Rav Chanina bar Shila. With the exception of Rav Chanina bar Shila, that if he dug into my house, I wouldn't kill him. My daima. Im leima mishum de tzadiku. If you think because he's a big tzadik, hakati b'machtarta. How big a tzadik could he be? He's digging under his house. Ela mishum de kimli b'gavei de merachim alai k'rachim aval ben. Because I know about him that he loves me the way that a father loves a child. And so I know he would never kill me. And since I know he would never kill me, I may not defend myself by killing him. So the Rav tells you here that this din is not uniquely between a father and a son. That is the assumption by a father and a son. But in other circumstances, you have relationships that simulate that feeling of a father towards a son. And in those relationships, then the same restriction would be in place. Tarbanan. Damim lo, ben b'chol, ben b'shabbat. If the person kills the ganav coming in when he's not supposed to, he'll be held accountable whether it's the weekday or whether it's Shabbat. Ein lo damim, in a case where he's permitted to murder the person coming in, ben b'chol, ben b'shabbat. It has implication on the weekday or on Shabbat. Right, it says, Bishlam, I understand, Ein lo damim, ben b'chol, ben b'shabbat. I understand why the Brit has to tell you that you're allowed to kill the person breaking into the house where you have that right, whether it's Chol or Shabbat, Itzrich. We need that. Salka datcha amina, because you would have thought, Midei dehavei aruget beit din. They should be the same as an execution of beit din. The b'shabbat lo katlinan. Beit din does not execute on Shabbat. So you would have thought maybe over here you'd also be restricted and not allowed to execute on Shabbat. Kamash v'lan de katlinan. But here we say kamash v'lan, that whether it's Chol or Shabbat, he's given permission to kill. So now, taking a step back based on the chakira that we said before, is the individual a proxy of Beit Din when he defends himself and kills the person coming to kill him? Or he's given vigilante rights? The Gemara's Havamin is clear that he is looking like a proxy of Beit Din. And just like Beit Din is not allowed to kill on Shabbat, we have a Havamina here that the person who's defending himself from the Machteret is not allowed to kill on Shabbat. That was Havamina. That means that we think that he is a proxy of Beit Din, or acting like a proxy of Beit Din. Kamash Malan, that we don't say that. Now the Kamash Malan can be read in one of two ways. The Kamash Malan is that you got it wrong. He's not a proxy of Beit Din. He is vigilante, and therefore he's not subject to the protocols or the necessities of a Beit Din. That's why he can kill in Shabbat. Or the Kamash Malan is that even though he's a proxy of Beit Din, he's given the right to kill on Shabbat here because this is not a formal execution. It's outside the rubric of Beit Din and therefore not subject to the restrictions of Lo Tevaruesh B'chol Moshevotechem B'yom HaShabbat.
And Rashi adds, in addition to that, there's Pikuach Nefesh here, and that the right to kill over here is because you will save the other individual, as opposed to the execution of Beit Din where the victim is already dead. Over here you have the opportunity to save the victim. And that Pikuach Nefesh is going to let us violate the Isurim of Shabbat. Well, that would imply that in other instances where you're permitted to kill the individual in order to stop them from committing a crime, that would not be permitted on Shabbat because there isn't the issue of Pikuach Nefesh for the victim.
So those are the two ways to read it, but again, the Havamina here makes it clear that there is a tzad, at least to say, that this person who kills in defense is really acting as a extension of the arm of justice or the extension of the Beit Din. Now, Ella damim lo ben b'chol ben b'shabbat. When he is held accountable for killing, that's whether it's on Chol and Shabbat. Hashtu b'chol lo katlinane. Over here, where it's a weekday, the owner's not given the right to kill the Baba Machteret. The Shabbat Mubayi, and Shabbat you have to tell me, and Shabbat is subject to other restrictions, which is violating Shabbat when he kills, also on top of the murder, so why would you think otherwise? So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Sheshet, lo nitzrucha ela lefakeach alav et hagal. Question is, do you have to dig him out if they collapsed on him? So the individual dug a tunnel into the house, Baba Machteret. On Shabbat he did this, and he's coming to steal on Shabbat. Then the tunnel collapses on him. We don't know if he's alive or if he's not alive. Do we have a responsibility to unearth him now to take him out? So that depends on what his story is. If it's Ein Lo Damim, if it's a case where the Baal HaBayit was allowed to defend himself by killing the Baba Machteret, then the person is a walking dead man. And when the tunnel collapses on him, we're not going to go dig him out because he's deserving of the death penalty, and we're not going to violate Shabbat to possibly extract him if he's still alive because he was subject to a death penalty and therefore we don't intervene. On the other hand, if the Baal HaBayit did not have a right to kill him, then he's not a walking dead man. And if he gets buried under there in the Machteret, he's no different than any other Jew, which we, if we have a safek as to whether he's alive or not, when we lefakeach et hagal, we go in there and unearth him to see if he's still alive, figure out if he's there. So since he didn't come on iskei nefashot, we dig him out. On the other hand, if he comes on iskei nefashot, since you're allowed to kill him, and Rashi adds in here, below Atra, which is the upcoming Gemara, gavra ktilu mishat chatira. He becomes a walking dead man from the time he goes in there, and therefore we don't take off the gal, we don't dig him out. Now, there are those, like the Meiri you want to suggest here, that's only if we have a safek, we don't dig him out. We're not going to be for safek, michal shabbat. But if we know he's alive for sure, the Meiri says, we unearth him, we dig him out. On the other hand, if you look at Rashi and what it sounds like from Rashi, it doesn't really matter. Even if we know he's alive, we're not going to go in there and unearth him, uncover him, because he was a walking dead man. And therefore, we have no obligation to go and unearth him, to dig him out. And we're not going to violate the Shabbat, even if we know that he's alive, because he deserves to die in that situation. So those are two views in the Rishonim as to whether when the guy is Chayav Mita, or the Baal HaBayit could defend himself by killing the individual, whether if we know for certain the person's alive and buried under, do we violate the Shabbat in order to save his life or try to extract him? But clearly, in a case of Safek, we don't go in and do it because since he was a walking dead man and it's a Safek, we're not going to violate the Shabbat in order to take him out. So the Pasuk says, if you find the person coming in or digging in to steal and you hit him and kill him, Ein lo damim, you're not responsible. So now the Braita says, Tarabanan v'huka b'chol adam, that the right to defend the Baal HaBayit does not just sit with the Baal HaBayit, but it is anybody who has the opportunity or the possibility of stopping this individual. So even if you're not the Baal HaBayit, you have a right to stop him. Since it doesn't say v'hikahu, that you kill him, but rather v'huka, that he be killed or be hit, that means that anybody can execute on this justice. Mate, you put him to death with any death penalty that you can. You have a right to use whatever means you have in your hands, in your possession, to kill him. So again here, it seems to me that the Gemara is connecting it to, we'll see in a second, the justice system. And just like in the justice system, you would have had a normal protocol of what you should do. So to over here, the way you should defend yourself is the way that they would have been tried and baked in, and Kamash Malan, that we don't say that. When it says, Bishma v'huka b'chol adam, I understand why you need v'huka b'chol adam, itzrich. You need it, b'sakadat chamina Baal HaBayit hu, de kimlei, den adam amir atzma mimano. Because the Baal HaBayit is the one who will defend his property to the death, and that's the one that the Baal HaMachteret is coming to kill, or assumes he will have to kill if he stands up next to him. Aval acher, someone else, lo, that would not be the case, and so maybe they wouldn't have the right to defend the Baal HaBayit. Kamash v'lan, the rodefu, that we classify the machteret as being a rodef, someone who's chasing after another person to kill them. V'afilu acher nami, not only is the victim allowed to defend himself, but even third parties can intervene to save the victim. The same will be true here, and that's the chiddush. Elo meit b'chol mitasha ata yechol amito, the fact that the Torah tells you can kill him any way possible, lamali. Why do I need that here? Mi rotseach nafka. We can learn it out from rotseach, from a murderer. Tatanya, mot yumat, makeh rotseachu. That the rotseach is subject to a death penalty. Ein li ela b'mita murabo. I would think that he gets the death penalty that is assigned to him, which is saif. Umiayin shimiata yachol amito b'mita ktuvabo. How do I know if you can't kill him by the saif? Shata rashay l'amito b'chol mita shata yachol amito. That you have a right to kill him any way possible. Tamalomar, mot yumat, mikol makom. The doubling of the Lashon of mot yumat tells you, make sure that he's dead.
The primary way to do it is through Saif, but if you can't accomplish it through Saif, then you do it by any means possible, as Rashi notes over here. For instance, in cases where Kagon Shaya Mechashef, he was a sorcerer, and therefore you can't kill him by the Saif, or there's a river sitting between you and that individual, and you can shoot him with an arrow, or hit him by a stone. It's interesting that Rashi brings up the Mechashef. It seems to be that Rashi thinks that Kishuf would work, or it's real and it could protect the individual from being killed. But Rashi says that if Beit Din is unable to execute him because of these reasons, then we use alternate methods, which is shooting him by an arrow, killing him by the stone, any method possible to put him to death. Shani hotam, damarka, mochumat. So Gemara says, by Rotseach, you have the double lashon of mochumat that gives you that permission. You don't have that by Rodeif. Gemara says, v'nigmar minei. Let that be a precedent. Let that be a paradigm, and we'll learn from that to machteret. V'shem davi Rotseach, v'gol adam, shnei k'tovim, abayim ke'achad. Problem with that is that we have two psukim in the Torah that teach you that same position, which is that you're allowed to kill him any way possible. And when you have two psukim that are telling you the exact same thing, then you can't extrapolate from that, or you can't learn from that as a paradigm to other cases. Because over here it says, Mochumat amakeh, seachu, and then earlier on, amemheim would bet, where we were learning about whether we take psukim literally or not. Over there, the Gemara tells us that your gol adam, your mita tarotzeach, mitzvah be gol adam. The mitzvah is for the gol adam to do it. Uminayim shem ein lo goel, shem beit din mamidim lo goel. How do I know that if there is no gol adam, that beit din intervenes to put a gol adam there? The pasuk says, shenemar bepigo bo bekol makom, that when he bumps into him, she kill him wherever that is or however that is. So you have here by the gol adam and the rotzeach, the requirement to put them to death, no matter how it's done, even though there is a normal protocol, or even though there is a normal procedure. As we noted before, we have one thing that's an exception to the rule, it is a paradigm. Because the Torah gives you an example and wants you to extrapolate it to everything else. If the Torah already gives you two items and gives you the same rule by them, it's telling you that these are the exceptions and there is no rule over here. And that's why Shnei Kedumim Avayim Kechad Ein Belamdim. So that's why we need the pasuk over here by Rodeif to tell you that the same din applies by a Rodeif. Tan Rabbanan, machteret. So this is the question that you asked before. Is this only true when he's tunneling in? So the pasuk says machteret, that he's tunneling in. Ein li ela machteret. I only know about tunneling in. Gago, chatzero, bekarpifo. If he entered through the roof, or he entered through an opening in the chatzer, or he came through the backyard, minayin, how do I know there that it's still the same din? Talnomar imatze haganav mikol makom. That if the ganav is found, then no matter what, you're allowed to defend yourself, you're allowed to kill the individual. Because it says imi machteret imatze haganav. So it's not just machteret, it's imatze haganav. Anytime the ganav is found in your house, you have a right of defense. Imke matamalomar machteret. So then why does the Torah specify machteret if it means any trespassing into your property? This was giving you the normal case. The normal case, or the most likely case, is that ganavim are coming in through a tunnel. They don't want to be caught. They don't want to end up in confrontation, so they try to do it as secretly as possible by digging tunnels underneath. But that doesn't mean that's the exclusive methodology for theft. And if you enter the property to steal, no matter how you got in there, you are considered to be above a machteret, even though you're not in a machteret, and the balabait has a right to kill you. Tanya Yidach, we have another braita. Machteret, in the other machteret, gogo chazero bekarpifo, minayin tamalomar yimatze aganav, mikol makom. Imke matamalomar machteret, machtarto zohi hachra'ato. So that braita tells you that it comes to machteret, comes to teach you that the digging of the tunnel is his hachra'ah, or the equivalent of hachra'ah. Now you can read this in one of two ways. You can read it that the bav machteret requires hachra'ah, because when you act to kill this individual, you are acting as a proxy of Beit Din. And just like in Beit Din, you can only kill if there was Hachra'ah, so too you need Hachra'ah over here. By the case of Machteret, you don't need Hachra'ah because the Machteret itself acts as Hachra'ah. A person knows if he enters into a tunnel and goes through that to go into a person's house, that the person is going to be there to defend his property, and therefore he knows that he is subject himself to the possibility that he'll be killed by the Balam Bayit who's defending his property and defending himself. So that's the equivalent of Hachra'ah. So that's one way to read it, which is that there is a requirement for Hachra'ah, and this replaces the Hachra'ah. Or, another way you could read it is that there's no necessity for Hatra'ah at all by Machteret, and it's saying to us that this is vigilantism. It's not working as Beit Din or protocol Beit Din where you normally would need Hatra'ah. Over here, you simply need to defend yourself. To act as a vigilante, you don't need Hatra'ah. You just act to protect yourself and your property. Amar Ravuna, Katan Rarudeif, Nitan Latzilo B'Nafsho. If you have a minor who's chasing, the way Rashi says it, chasing after another minor, then you're allowed to kill the minor who is the Rodeif. Kasava Rodeif Eino Tzarich Hatra'ah. So from that you would see that Ravuna believes that a Rodeif does not require Hatra'ah. Loshna Gadol, Loshna Katan. Doesn't matter if he is of age or not of age, there is no requirement of Hatra'ah, and that's why you have the right to kill this Katan to protect the victim. Eitavei Rav Chista Ravuna, so Rav Chista challenges Ravuna's position. Yatzar Rosho Eino Gimbo. If the head of the baby emerges, you're not allowed to touch it. Lefish Ein Dochim Nefesh Mipnei Nefesh. Because we don't kill one life to spare the life of the other. So this is based on the Mishnah Noalot. We actually quoted it earlier in the Gemara back on Nuntet Amud Aleph. Because over there the Tosafot discussed this issue of abortion. And over here, we're quoting the actual Mishnah from Olot, which was the other piece of the puzzle to that sugya. We discussed the abortion back on Nuntet Amud Aleph. Everything we said then obviously is applicable over here. This is another source or a part of the picture that brings that puzzle together. The Mishnah Olot begins with the following. If the mother's life is in danger while the baby is still in utero, then we have a right to kill the baby. We have a right to take the baby out. Aver, aver. In order to protect the life of the mother. Rashi explains here why that is b'chol zman shelo yatzah la'avir olam, because as long as the baby is yet to emerge, lav nefeshu, he's not considered to be a living being. So now, Tosafot was bothered by that back on Nuntet Amud Aleph, that's why he says it can't be that he's not a living being, and therefore it's totally mutar, but rather, what it's saying is that there is an isur here, but that isur is waived when there's pikuach nefesh, when there's life-threatening situations for the woman. But what you see here is that, number one, the fetus is not considered to be a living being. Number two is we protect the life of the mother even at the expense of the baby. The baby is considered to be a rodeif, and therefore we eliminate the baby in order to protect the life of the mother. So then the Mishnah there continues and says, once the baby's head emerges, then you don't have a right to kill it. Because ein dochim nefesh mipnei nefesh. We don't knock off one life for the benefit of another life. Now, the question on Rav Huna is, you just told us that if a katan is a rodeif, you're allowed to take the life of the katan to protect the victim. Why don't we say the same thing over here? We understood when in utero it wasn't classified as a living being, that's why you took the life of the fetus to protect the mother. Now the baby's head emerges and now it's a living being. But in the meantime, he's going to kill his mother. But my rodeifu is... So why isn't he classified as a rodeif? A rodeif that is a katan, and Rav Huna says a rodeif that's a katan, you can kill. So why is it here that we don't say that, and we say, we don't take the life of the baby to protect the mother. Why not? He is a rodeif. The Gemara's answer is, shani hotam, dimishmaya karatfila. The baby is not what's causing her the problem here, but rather it is the will of Shemayim that she either be in trouble or die here, and it's not the baby that's doing it. The Rambam, actually, when he codifies this in the Mishnah Torah, doesn't bring the reason of Min HaShemayim Radfila, that they are actually killing her Min HaShemayim, but rather that birth is dangerous. Giving birth is a dangerous thing, and many times ends up in, unfortunately, with death. And so given that, when the baby emerges and the woman's life is in danger, the baby's not doing something that is extraordinary, out of the ordinary. The mother's life many times when giving birth is in danger. That's part and parcel of giving birth. And so since that's the case, we don't classify the baby as being a rodeif, but rather the circumstance or situation as being the problem. Therefore, we don't kill the baby to save the mother's life. Yushalmi, on the other hand, gives a different reason and says, we don't know who the rodeif is over here. We don't know if it's the baby that's killing the mother or the mother that's killing the baby. We don't know who the rodeif is. And since there is a safek over here, we're going to act passively and we're not going to intervene to protect the life of the mother at the expense of the baby or vice versa. We're going to let happen whatever happens and whoever survives, survives. Because of the safek, we don't want to intervene in this situation. That's the view of the Rishami.
In our situation, the Gemara says, Minashamayim Radfila, that from Minashamayim they're coming to kill her because the fetus that's emerging does not have will, does not have enough of a understanding that they're coming to be a Rodeif. He's not intentionally being a Rodeif. He's not trying to kill the mother. It's the circumstances in which he's born is causing his mother to be in danger. And so therefore we don't take his life, as opposed to the case by Rav Huna, where the Katan is actively engaging and trying to kill someone else. So over there, they're considered to be a Rodeif, because there it's not, you can't say it's Min HaShemayim. He made a choice. He's chasing after someone. He knows what he's doing, and he's trying to kill them. But over here, where the baby doesn't know, we can't classify him as a Rodeif. Rashi over here raises an issue of Sheva ben Bichri. Yoav surrounds the city and demands that Sheva ben Bichri be given up. If they don't give him up, he's going to kill the whole city. In the end, this Isha Kochma there gets Sheva ben Bichri's head. She gets the people in the city to rebel against him, take off his head, and hand it out to the troops outside. Rashi says, why do you have a right to kill Sheva ben Bichri to save the city? When we have this principle of Ein Dochin Nefesh Mipnei Nefesh, that we don't kill one person to save the life of another. So Rashi answers here, and this is an important principle, comes up, unfortunately, in situations that are very difficult, but in a situation where the army comes and says, we're going to kill everybody in the city, unless you hand over so-and-so. Now, if you do absolutely nothing, they're going to kill the entire city, including so-and-so. So if that's the situation, this so-and-so is going to die either way. So why not give him up in order to protect the lives of the city? And that's basically the logic that Rashi says here, the woman used in giving up Sheva ben Bichri, which is that Sheva ben Bichri is going to be dead either way. Whether they gave him up to Yoav, or whether they didn't give him up to Yoav and the troops came in and killed out the city, he was going to end up dead. So better to have him die and save the remainder of the city, and that's the logic here as to why they gave him up. But in an alternate situation in which he would be saved, or he could survive, then you don't have a right to give over this person to death in order to save, whether it's one person or many people, since he's not subject to a death penalty or definitive death, you don't have the right to give him over in order to protect yourself or in order to protect others. And again, this comes up in the Holocaust response literature and other difficult times where Jews have to give over Jews to be killed. What right do you have to do that? Is there a right to do that when it saves other people's lives? What is the circumstance, the situation? And Rashi is already giving you some of that background, raising some of the issue, which is, what's the status of this individual, and what is going to happen to this individual will impact on how we feel about giving over that individual to the authorities. Or the other possibility, Rashi says, it has nothing to do with our sugya, it has to do with the fact that he was a Morid B'Malchut. Since he was a Morid B'Malchut, he was deserving of the death penalty, and so that's why they handed him over to the troops, or handed him over to Yoav. And anyway, as is clear from here, that this Mishnah in Ohalot, as well as the Rashi over here that says that a fetus is not considered to be a nefesh, has impact on how we view abortion. Again, you have to look at the Tosafot back on Nun Ted Amud Aleph, says that despite what you might feel from this Gemara that seemingly indicates that it's not a problem, there's still an underlying issur there of hapalat ubar, of causing abortions, even if the fetus is not classified as a full-fledged nefesh. All right, name of Asayile. Let us say here we have a braita that supports the position of Rav Huna, that a katan rodeif is subject to being killed. Rodeif, shei rodeif et achar chaviro lo orgo. If a person chasing after another person to kill them, omer lo, if he says to him, re'ei shisrael hu, uben britu, you know that you're chasing after a Jew, he is a fellow member of the congregation, of the covenant, v'tor amra, shofeich dam adam badam, damo yishafeich, that if you spill on someone else's blood, that you are going to be held accountable for that. Amar Torah, Hatzel Damo Shel Zeh B'Damo Shel Zeh. Torah says you are allowed to kill this person to protect the victim in this situation. Now, in this braita, you lack hatra'ah. We're going to see in a second what proper hatra'ah is, but over here, you do not have proper hatra'ah. Even though this person acknowledges that he's killing a Jew, that's not enough to be classified as hatra'ah. Hadra'ah means that he has to release himself to death and say afal pi kein, which is that when you warn him about this, he says, I know, despite that I'm going ahead and killing him, meaning that I know that I'm subject to a death penalty, and despite that I'm going to go ahead and do this. That's called hadra'ah. We don't have that in this braita. And so what's indicated through this braita is there's no necessity for hatra'ah. Since there's no necessity for hatra'ah, that means a rudev can be killed, even a katan rudev can be killed, because there's no necessity for hatra'ah. If you did require hatra'ah, then we might think otherwise, because the katan does not have the ability to accept hatra'ah, or to maybe possibly understand hatra'ah, and so then he can't be made into a rudev. Anyway, this is what I noted earlier also, that the pasuk that they quote, in warning the person of being a rodeif, is shofek dam adam adam, damo yishofek, they quote the pasuk from Ben Noach, and not any pasuk from the Torah, probably or likely because it's the most explicit in stating the fact that if you kill someone or you're trying to kill someone, that you're subject to a death penalty, even though that's not written by Israel, but nevertheless, we use that as the paradigm for teaching us that din. My answer is no, that doesn't necessarily have a proof to Rav Huna. Hi, Rav Yossi, Rav Yehuda. That writer is authored by Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda. The time Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda Omer Chaver in Tzarich Hatra. Someone who's a Chaver doesn't need Hatra. The fish don't need Hatra. Levchim and Shogeg the Mezid. Hatra is only used to differentiate between a person who's killing unintentionally and killing intentionally. I mean, any case, he's doing it unintentionally or intentionally. Over here, you don't have any question about the fact that he's doing this intentionally, especially since you've already warned him. And that's enough to classify the person as having hatra'ah, because hatra'ah is just to bring you into the realm of mezid. So Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, doesn't require an acceptance of hatra'ah. Others think that hatra'ah is there, and he has to accept, he has to free himself to be killed. That's called hatra'ah. On the other hand, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda says it's just informative in nature, and therefore you don't need a Kabbalah. So even if it's a amaretz, the fact that he told him you're chasing after a Jew, that's enough to make you into a mezid in this case, and you don't need him to accept the hatra'ah. That doesn't mean that that is the broader position of the Tanaim, that you don't need hatra'ah. Maybe you do need hatra'ah in other cases. And if that's true, then Rav Huna's din would be problematic of a katan being classified as a rodev. Tashma, rodev she'e rodev achar chavirelo or go. You have a rodev chasing his friend to kill him. Rei she'yisrael ho. Take note, the fact you're chasing a Jew, ben brito, and he's a member of the covenantal nation. Tosafot explains over here the reason that he asked him the question of Israel and Ben Brit is he's in Israel and not a Kuti. Ben Brit, v'lo mumar lo ve'ed kochavim. Someone who doesn't worship Avodah Zarah, not someone who is subject to a death penalty anyway because he's a mumar the Avodah Zarah. There's two statements. One statement to distinguish between Jew and non-Jew, and then another statement to distinguish within Jews that he's someone that has faith in Hashem and is not someone who's a mumar the Avodah Zarah. But Torah Amra, Shofek Dam Adam Adam, Damo Yishofek. And one who spills blood of another, his blood will be spilled. And the way Rashi terms it over here, Kol Ru'eh Uto Yishofek Damo. Anybody who sees him should spill his blood. And this is the opening up of that possibility that a Rodef is subject to vigilantism, which is that anyone can kill him. Im Omar Yodeh Anishu Kain. He says, yeah, I know that. Patur. Because then he didn't accept the hatra'ah. He was notified, but he didn't accept it. Amnat kein ani oseh. He says, I know that, and I'm doing it in that intent, and I know that anyway. Chayav. Then he's chayav. That's acceptance of the hatra'ah. Brachta seems to indicate you do need hatra'ah. And if you do need hatra'ah, then a katan can't be classified as a rodeif, because he's not a bar hatra'ah. Lo, tzricha, dekoy betray ivrei denaro. It's a case where the person who's warning him is on the other side of the river. So he can't save the victim from the aggressor here because he's on the other side of the river. Because he doesn't have the ability or the means by which to save the victim. So So what is he going to do? The only opportunity he has is to bring this guy into Beit Din and have Beit Din deal with it. He can't do it himself, so he wants to bring him into Beit Din. Beit Din by Atra. And Beit Din requires Atra. So in that situation, he's giving Atra because he doesn't have a choice. He doesn't have the opportunity to kill him, to protect the victim by killing the aggressor. The only thing he has is the ability to bring him to Beit Din, and therefore he's preparing for that eventuality and giving the hatra'ah. But that doesn't mean that every rodeif needs hatra'ah. I hold like the Tana Machteret, Amar Machterto, Zoe Hatra'ato. Who says that going into the Machteret in itself is hatra'ah. Over here Rashi gives the explanation, which is, since we automatically assume that he is a rodeif, he doesn't need hatra'ah. So it's not that we see that the machteret replaces hatra'ah over there, and he really does need hatra'ah, but the machteret's replacing it. It's the fact that he is there that automatically gives us his status, and therefore it's not necessary to have hatra whatsoever in that case. So that's one of the two tzadin that we said before about what that means in terms of maktarto, zohi hatrato. And that's a sentiment that's also echoed by the Yad Ramah, which is that we're certain that the Rodef is coming to kill, and therefore there's no need for Hatra anymore. It's embedded in the action that he took that he doesn't need a warning, or Hatra is not necessary in this case.
Although from Rashi earlier, and from Tosfot on the Amud Aleph, it seems like he makes a distinction between how the Ganav enters. If the Ganav enters via Machteret, then Machterato hi Hatrato. On the other hand, if he enters through the Gag, the Chatzer, the Karpaf, over there, Tosfot says he does require hatra'ah. And so that would indicate that there really is a need for hatra'ah, and the machteret stands in as the hatra'ah in this case. It's not that we just assume that he is a murderer coming in through the machteret, and that's why there's no requirement of hatra'ah. There is a requirement of hatra'ah, and the machteret functions as that hatra'ah. So that's the alternate side of our view here, which is that there is a requirement of hatra'ah, and just the machteret sits in as replacing that. Versus saying that one who comes in this way, there's no necessity in this case for hatra'ah, because hatra'ah is not necessary when someone comes in this manner, because they're automatically deemed to be a rodef. So those are the different ways you can look at machtarto hi hatra'ato. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the bottom of Ayin Bet Amud Bet.